Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Entrepreneurial Impact with Joe Martin and Dave Donaldson, your host. And then we have the pleasure of our guest, Tommy Flood, who's the Director of Growth for 14 brokerages across North Texas, New Mexico, and Memphis territories. And Tommy, I've had the pleasure of working with you within brokerage leadership, so I'm really excited to have you on today. And being that we're a podcast about entrepreneurial impact, love to know your journey from where you started to how you got into your leadership within real estate and your entrepreneurial journey.
Oh, thanks for having me, Joe. David, it's a pleasure to be here. And I love being on your podcast. I love listening to your podcast. Entrepreneurialism is something that has inspired me and motivated me, I would say, even before I moved into manhood and adulthood. It has been something that, I started my first company when I was 16 years old. I started a company called TNT Enterprises, and we cleaned five office buildings every evening. Started out with one, and I just kept building and getting more and more contracts. I ended up having three cleaning crews that worked with me every night. I did that to basically fund my way through high school and go there. After graduating high school, like most of my friends, as I went through college, a lot of them started mowing yards. And unfortunately for me, mowing a yard, not that there's anything wrong with that, but I wanted more than that. I wanted to own a company. So my next step into entrepreneurialism was at the time, Circle K had 54 locations in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. And yes, strange things are afoot.
Yeah, I was just about to drop that in there.
For all of my Bill and Ted's fans out there, show my age. But I got a wild hair idea that I would go pitch Circle K, that it would be a better idea to have one person mow all of their locations so that they could control the quality and just talk to one person rather than have each and every store go hire their own crew to come by and mow every week. So ended up with 54 of them. A year later, I purchased another commercial landscaping business, added 85 yards to that. At our peak, we did 175 commercial locations weekly. And I did that to kind of fund my way through my college.
So I was just kidding. How old were you when you did that?
That was 19 and 20.
And you don't look like you have skin cancer. So congratulations. You wore a nice hat.
Best shape I'd ever been in my life. And yes, best tan I ever had.
There's nothing like landscaping. I tell you, I did it too. Here's the difference though. Like I did it and I had 5 or 6 yards and I shoveled those yards, right? I didn't understand entrepreneurialism. My parents were both longtime employees, right? My dad worked for the city. So I couldn't define, let alone spell, entrepreneurism at 16 or 19, right? But I wasn't exposed to it. So I look at that and I go, how does that happen, right? How did somebody like you at that age get exposed to that? Did you just inertly have it? Or was there something you saw through somebody else that said, there's more in building a business than just delivering papers for 60 houses or cutting 5 lawns?
It was my dad.
Okay.
So my dad was a classic employee. Both of my parents were officers in the banking industry. My dad was president of a bank. My mom was a vice president of a bank. Banker's hours, 3-piece suit every day to work, like classic employee. But my dad always wanted more than that. So my dad was always buying, as long as I can remember, my dad was buying rental properties, and we spent weekends going and repainting new homes, and refurbishing new homes and doing those kind of little handyman projects. I mean, as far back, even when I was 5 years old, I remember he bought a rent property and said, "Here, Tommy, go paint the doghouse." They had like a actual permanent doghouse outside and told me I could paint the doghouse. A skill that my dad had, and I'm not near as good at him as it, but a skill that my dad had was the ability to put a deal together. And my dad didn't always find the deal, but if somebody else found the deal, my dad had the ability to put the pieces together and make it work. And I watched him do that, and he always inspired me. He always He always pushed me to go to school, have a career, and also be an entrepreneur as well. It was, you know, if you talk about Robert Kiyosaki's cash flow quadrants, it was before that. But my dad was, go play in all four quadrants at all time. That was kind of, he said, you're going to have a job, you'll be an employee. And then figure out how what businesses can you own? How do you use your job to go buy other businesses that you're in there? And then how do you begin to invest, right, into other aspects of that as you go? And so he began to work me through both sides of the four quadrants and taught me that you don't have to be stuck in one. Figure out how you can play in all of them when you need to, and then how you can move out and graduate and move on as you have. And there's Joe, I love leadership. You know that. Like it's my passion to work with leaders and people. And so being in all four quadrants allows me to expand and influence and expand a platform to talk to more leaders than I probably would if I was just self-employed or owned one small business and had three people that I led. I've always wanted to be able to see how do I get my bus bigger and get as many people on there as I can so that I can influence through leadership development and so forth.
So you got the commercial contracts in landscaping. What's the next venture for Tommy?
The next venture was I jumped into, I kept that going on the side. I stepped out of that and I jumped into the mortgage world and long time ago. I'm not going to date myself too badly here, but 1992, I jumped into the mortgage
world. We weren't going to ask you the dates.
I jumped into the mortgage world and started working down that path very quickly. I had an associate of mine who, this will also date me, who created an algorithm that would download the data from MLS books onto a CD-ROM program. And I traveled the country and opened seven different markets, leading a traveling sales team where markets where people had to take the book as being a part of MLS. And the book was being delivered every 2 weeks. We were able to provide a data product that showed up every week and went out. And I did that for the better part of 2.5 years. About that time, I came back home and my family and I saved up my money and I bought into a mortgage company. And we started and launched our own mortgage company at that time. Shortly after that, my mother got a real estate license and we bought she started at Keller Williams. And then about a year and a half later, we bought a RE/MAX franchise. And so we ran a RE/MAX franchise. We ran a mortgage franchise that we had there. I was an investor in both of those, helped build those through. My main role was coaching the real estate agents and coaching the loan officers. I got out of production and moved into coaching and consulting them and leading them in both of those organizations. And honestly, Joe, I'll tell you, you know my history and my background. It was about 3 years into that. I had a spiritual awakening and I got a wild hair and decided to go to Bible school and sold my share of everything and decided to go down to Florida and spend 2 years going through a seminary training school. So
let me ask you this question, because a lot of people are like, oh, it's been a phenomenal journey of, you know, dabbling in all kinds of different exposures and experiences and people. And, you know, you put yourself into situations where just, I think I'm a big proponent of like intentional practice, meaning like you can read a book, you can watch a manual or video or whatever, but until you get your like actually ride the bike, you don't really learn anything. So when you look at all those experiences, right, what's the one common denominator within leadership that because of your skills and dedication to it, it allowed you to succeed in all, because you have such a vast, diverse, like business track and entrepreneurialism that like you had to have one thing, a lowest common denominator that the leadership kind of came through. And what would you say to people listening that like, hey, if you're going to try all these different ventures, here's like 2 to 3 things in leadership that you've got to knock out of the park because they can actually translate to running businesses, no matter what type of field it's in.
I think the first one is developing people around you. and the skill set around what it takes to develop people. I think that in whatever I talked about the four cash flow quadrants, right? You'll always stay self-employed until you're able to hire somebody else and develop them. I read a lot. Joe, you and I talk about books a lot in that realm. And I'm a fan of Michael Malkowitz, right? Mm-hmm. And he gives a definition of entrepreneur in one of his books. I don't remember which one it is.
Next.
Okay, so it was his mentor that told it to him, right? And he said, a true entrepreneur is someone who's able to identify the processes that make a business run and then figures out how to duplicate those processes, automate those processes, and hand them off to someone else so that they can then grow the business. And I think that is, it's something that I probably felt in my heart. I would say, so one was developing people. The second was really identifying processes. Mm-hmm. What makes it successful? And I don't know that I knew that definition. I didn't have those words. But when I read those words in that book, it was like I found the lyrics to the song I'd been humming for about two decades.
And it's a great analogy.
Yeah. It was like, I knew that that's what those words are. And I feel like that's probably my second. My first thing that I would say transcends all, whether it's full ministry, mm-hmm. or, you know, when I was vocationally that for 10 years, or I guess actually 14 years, or, and did entrepreneurialism on the side, or full-time entrepreneurial, or, you know, being regional director and running, you know, being an employee and owning businesses mm-hmm. at the same time. In any of those, the success level depends on how well can you develop people and what's your plan and your system around developing people. How well can you identify processes so you can repeat wins?
So I think this is brilliant for people, right? Is that like, it's two things. It's basically developing people so that you get time back, but also giving them skills to be more capable and, you know, to get a better earning opportunity and all those type of things, right? When you talk about the impact of people. And then the system side is that they can be replicable and that you have consistent results in the outcome of the product that you're creating, whether it's a service or product. And I think it's that simple, right?
Yeah.
The question I want to like speed up to present day is like, think about when you got back into real estate, wherever that was. And then now you're today over 14 brokerages, regional director, jack of all trades, and pick a title you want to give to Tommy. This is pretty much everything he's done inside of residential brokerage, right? And that's why it's amazing to be able to have him as a friend and colleague and be able to have him on the podcast. Is that my question is, some people, we were just having another podcast with another like business colleague, and it was like people forget what you have to go through to get to the level that you're at today for success. If you look at like what you had to go through from going back into real estate to them where you're at today, what were the things that most people don't know about that are absolutely necessary to get the level of success that you've achieved right now in your personal and professional life?
The time and the grind that it takes, I think, is number one. I've probably always done a pretty decent job of looking like it's all together, looking like I've got leverage around me, looking like I've got systems and stuff in place at times. But those closest to me know that that is not the case. And I would say just the mere time, also the willingness to fail. Like I don't know that I nailed it the first time ever. I don't know of one opportunity I look back at thinking about this podcast and looking back over, you know, now a better part of 40 years, you know, 35, 40 years. I don't know that I've ever nailed it the first time through. And just really being able to be willing to fail. And I think, so Joe, I'll tell you this. I think this is the deal about systems or processes or whatever you want to call them. And that is, you've got to duplicate what you do well. Mm-hmm. You've got to know what winning is, and you've got to duplicate wins. Don't go try to build processes to overcome failure. You've got to mm-hmm. elbow grease your way through failure. And then you create a process that duplicates a win. And I think a lot of times entrepreneurs look at certain aspects of their business and think, I need to go buy this tool, or I need to go create this system, or I need to go adopt this system that Joe does because he kills it at this. And I need to go adopt that to my business. And while that may help you a little bit, I don't believe that a process or anything is going to make you better unless it's something that you've already been good at. And you then can add a system, you can add a tool, you can add technology, you can add people to go amplify your wins. And so I would say how much hard work there is, how much work there is behind the scenes when it looks great, but probably just a willingness to fail and a willingness to say, I failed and I've got to figure out now, and I've got to go work extra hard to figure out how do I get right at it this time. Mm-hmm. And then once I figured out how I've nailed it twice, now I can document how that worked two times in a row and I can pass that on to somebody else.
Yeah, I love that mindset with that. But I'm looking back at your story and you had some immediate success, obviously. Like started building companies, merging companies. But when you stepped away from that, right, and you went on your seminal journey, what in that experience allowed you to have that willingness to fail? Because I think there's a belief that you have to have, because you didn't experience it because you had been successful from the beginning, but you went to experience something that I think kind of awakened something in you.
Yeah. Well, and I also say, David, one of the things that, you know, I don't tell in the early story is for the sake of time is when I got fired from the first building that hired me to clean it. Right. How many different landscape customers let me go? How many loan officers or realtors left our company at the time because they didn't feel that we were adequately helping them? Opening 7 markets for the MLS CD-ROM company was phenomenal and wonderful. And the first one was a flop. 2 through 6 were great. And then the 7th one was the reason why I left altogether. those were there. And the value of relationship amplified my life through my time. When I went to seminary, I jumped into ministry. There's nothing like working for a ministry or a church or anything like that. Everybody's a volunteer. Ain't nobody got to do nothing you ask them to do. And you've got to figure out a way to lead and to motivate and to inspire people to want to be on the journey, want to be on the bus, want to be in the seat that fits them and wants to go. I think I learned that during that time that has actually been what has caused me to propel since 2013 when I jumped out. It's where I learned probably one of my most favorite sayings, and that is the person who gives the most hope has the most influence. And I think that comment, that quote, I heard a man say that probably circa 2005, 20 years ago now. And the person who I follow in business now, Smokey Garrett, he always says, you got to have hope. You got to give hope and a step. And I think that's one of the very early things that we aligned together in our business mindsets is the more hope I can hand somebody, the more influence I have, which allows me to drive what I know is best for an organization.
And this is actually the perfect segue into like the one reason, like when I was thinking about like, who do we want on the podcast? It was like, I want Tommy on mainly because in my experience and work with you and just interactions is that the one part of your leadership that I value a ton and look at for what you do positively is that your influence. And I don't mean influence in the level of like, hey, I can motivate people and I can inspire people. Those are both fleeting and they're both internally driven. But influence is something that can be externally done to actually lead people. And I think the cool part that I've experienced, at least in my interactions, has been one of inspiration through the influence that you have, because I've never heard your engagements with one-on-one, small groups, large groups is always a positive, uplifting future, right? It doesn't matter how bad the situation is. you can define reality like any great leader, but there's always an inspirational bigger picture thing. And I think that gift brings a different dynamic to the people that are in your organization. And I think I would love for you to kind of dive a little bit into that for what you think is like best practices, how you got there and how people can integrate that into their world. Because I think it's actually it's a great gift. It's a soft skill that a lot of people don't have. And I think it's invaluable to an organization.
Well, thank you for that. I'm glad you did clarify a positive future, because I do know you and I have had several old fashions around a not so positive present. So I'm glad you clarified that. When looking at it, I would say that for me, there's always a solution and there's always an answer. Nothing is, again, I'm going to go back to it's one of the skill sets I learned from my dad. And the reason my dad was amazing at putting deals together was there was always a way to make something work. And I think that no matter how you look at it, there's always the ability to make something work. Now, don't get me wrong, Joe, that bites me in the butt sometimes. I innately believe in the best in everybody, and I'm trying to find it and pull it out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's great and sometimes it's not. However, I would just say, basic conversation. I go back to what we talked about earlier, building. How do you practically look at that? It's a very difficult thing to do to build a business on processes that are fixing problems. It is a much easier thing to do to build a business building processes to duplicate results and duplicate wins. And I think that's one, I'm repeating myself from earlier, but that truly is one of the most practical things in keeping a positive outlook on the future is you focus on winning, right? And you focus on what does it take to win.
Yeah.
And I think when you're developing people, you focus on what are they doing that's winning. I firmly believe that any human being will be better focusing on how they win and how they're winning and how do they get better at that and finding and working on behind the scenes and leveraging around how do I get better at where my gaps are. You know, we have in our world, Joe, we have the six personal perspectives inside of the Keller Williams world, right? And the first one of those is self-mastery. I've always heard one of the best definitions of that is I know what my goal is. I know what my strengths are. I know what my weaknesses are. And I'm going to go maximize my strengths and fill in for my weaknesses so that I can go hit my goal. And I think that awareness is something that probably I've had most of my life. I'm really self-aware of what I'm not good at. That's conversations I have with people all the time is like when somebody wants to sit there and tell me what I'm not good at, I get frustrated very quickly. And they're like, why? What is this bad? Nope, it's not bad. I just know. I know I stink at that. I know that's horrible. You don't have to tell me. But I do believe in focusing that out is I also know I'm good at this. And so how do I go double down on that? How do I go double down on what's working? How do I go double down on what's good? Because if you have that mindset in place to begin with, it helps you see there will be a win in the end.
Yeah.
There will be a win in the end. And so I think that's one of the most, so I do it for myself. And I try to do it for the people I'm developing in my organization.
You know,
yeah. How do I keep that going?
I think it's crazy how challenging it can be sometimes to stay out of the negative, right? It's that cascading domino that everybody can jump on that really easy, like yeah. But having the positive, I think there's a time and place to recognize, right, what your challenges are, right, but not compound that with acceptance of it, right? But being able to surround yourself and live in the positive is so much harder. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, it's human nature, David. I mean, think about this, right? My wife, Teresa, uses this example all the time. I think it's hilarious. So if you're standing in line at the grocery store, it is easier to bond over negativity than positivity. It's easier. Think about this. I'm standing in line at the grocery store and it's taking forever. I look at the person behind me with the cart behind me. It's so much easier to look at them and go, good God, this is taking forever. How long is this going to take? Do you think they could open up another lane? Like, and we bond immediately over what the problem is. Or I can look at them and go, man, look, can you believe how expensive these eggs are? Right? And that becomes an immediate point of conversation that doesn't feel awkward or weird in any way, shape, form, or fashion. But if I look at the same person behind me and go, oh, you like goldfish? I like goldfish too. All of a sudden now it's weird. And
I'm stealing that from Teresa.
It takes work. It takes work to bond over positivity.
Yeah.
And it takes somebody willing to go out there and look like that they're, sometimes you're going to look like you're pie in the sky. Sometimes you're going to look like everything's through rose colored glasses. Sometimes in the world, I'm like, look, okay, so I realize I'm a very high optimistic person, but I'm about to put my skepticism hat on, just so you know. And I think it's also, David, I think it's important that you have a place to have an outlet.
Yeah.
Right? I got to have a place that I can go chunk a chair against a wall and yell shit. Like, I got to have that place to do it. But you also need to be very careful about who that is with.
Oral Joe, passions.
I didn't do that with you in the beginning of our relationship, in the beginning of our partnerships together. It took a while to where I wanted you to know I am solution oriented. I am positive future. I'm a winner. And I know there's a way to get that done before. I need a time, Joe, to just have an old fashioned and talk about negative present.
Yeah. Now that's really what I wanted to hear. And I appreciate it because we hear the things like know your audience, but really you got to know who to trust, right? Because there's a time and a place where that voice needs to be, you got to get it out, right? Yeah, whether it's thrown against a chair or having it old fashioned, but at the same time, okay, I feel better now, but being consciously present of who is around you and what you say, unfortunately, is a challenging behavior too. Like, living in that and going, okay, I have to mind my audience. I got to know what I'm saying here. And saying the weird things is changing the conversation to making everybody see that that's okay too.
No solution is going to come from just talking about problems. Yeah. It never does. And I think that's one of the bigger things that I kind of go at those conversations. Joe, when you talk about it, we sit around and we talk about, how do we transition to this? Well, what are we going to do then? Like, right. I get it. This is broken. Yes. This stinks. Yes. This is not working. So what are we going to do? Like, either A, let's quit and go do something else. All right. So as a survivor of two types of cancer, chemo and that part of life, I ain't got time to sit around and just talk about how everything's wrong and not go fix it. Like, there's other stuff I could go do than just sit around and spend the day in negative land. I've got to go find out how to make it better.
I think what you're bringing up psychologically is that if I point out all the things that are wrong or problems, I'm inherently right. But my ability to focus on a solution, I might be 50% right. I might say, hey, here's a solution for it. I haven't proven it yet. And I might go fail 10, 15 times before I get the solution. So I think a lot of people immediately default to the negative because I can be 100% right. You can't make me wrong. Whereas if I try to give you a solution for the problem that we have, it might not be right. And then I look like I got egg in my face based on if we go out and fail and try to fix it. And I think that has something to do with it in regards to like what people focus on, right?
I agree. Joe, I'll say this. Joe and David, I think one of the you just said something that clicked. And that is, I think one of the reasons people stay in the negative too long is they're waiting to get more information. Or they're trying to gather more information. And the longer you're waiting to make a decision, the faster you make a decision to change something, the faster you move out of negativity and into positivity.
100%.
I think it's Colin Powell that says you should make every decision with somewhere between 40 and 70% of the information needed. that if you make it before 40%, then you don't have enough information to make a good decision. But if you wait until you have more than 70%, you're just taking too long and delaying, and you're not moving fast enough.
Opportunity passage.
I love that metric. Yeah. I love setting that range.
Yeah.
Well, I think from what Tommy brought up, this is what I want to hear everybody that was like tuned in. It's just like what Tommy brought up was on the first part was assume positive intent from the people around you. That if you don't assume positive intent, you're going to, conspiracy theory comes out the woodwork and you got challenges there, right? Then you've got a general consensus of like impacting people that if I can get to my goal, there's other benefits in just getting the goal. It's that this person got confidence, they got skill set, they've got experience, and they're actually doing something that provides them self-worth. And I think that's actually when I look at people is that like you're providing self-worth because how many people in their life can count on one hand how many people believe in them? Like if you actually thought around your people, like this is one of the things that drives me in leadership is I know so many stories. If I didn't have anybody, I didn't have this, I didn't have that. And they can count on their hand five people that actually have said, you know what? You might not believe in yourself, but I believe in you. And like that means the world from transitioning and changing people's trajectory in life with confidence. The next one I think Tommy brings up is systems, mainly like, is it replicatable? And do you have a system around it? And I think the asterisk on that one is focus on systems that are already delivering wins because your wins compound. And if you're trying to develop systems to fix your problems, you haven't mastered what the system is to get to a win. So you're basically just doubling down on problems. And I think the final part is hope. I think if anybody else hears this one, you can go through the little things I just brought up, but generally hope that if you can give hope for a positive future, it gives people a future to look at. I saw this quote recently that says, don't hire people and assign tasks to them like building a ship. Like don't assign them the task to guide the ship. Don't assign them the task to build the wood on the ship. Cast a vision of a future of how great it's going to be on those waves. And then when you get to some certain future that they don't even know they can achieve, that hope allows them to move through all the muddy water when they might actually give up or not have faith in themselves.
Joe, if I can say one last thing, I think in that realm of people, what you just said made me think of like the word empower people is so used, maybe overused a lot of times, right? I'm empowering people. And I think that it's misused a lot because to truly empower somebody means I give them the power to go do it. Not I give them a list of tasks to go do. I give them the power to go figure out how to do it. And I just think that is, as we go through that process of building the system, empowering people, creating hope, pointing out the wins and what they're doing well. One way you do that is by truly empowering them, by truly saying, here you go, I'm hands off and we're going to watch and we're going to let you have the power to do it. And we're gonna let you grow and build on that.
It's huge. Well, Dave, you want to bring us home?
Yeah. Listen, it was a moving episode and a very deep thought. Like we have a lot of different energy around a lot of different things that we have a conversation for. This was a deep think. And I really appreciate your insight and your passion around that, Tommy. So for those of you that are home, take time to allow yourself to process where you are, who you're present with, and who you surround yourself with, right? And I hope you surround yourself with us each and every Wednesday here on Entrepreneurial Impact. So for Joe, myself, and our guest, Tommy Flood, we'll see you next week.